Welcome to the podcast series from the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration 2023, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You're listening to the lecture on the Global Anti-Trafficking Framework, its overview, issues and debates by Samuel Okiere, a senior lecturer in sociology at the School of Sociology, Politics and International Studies at the University of Bristol. Samuel is a founding member of the Beyond Trafficking and Slavery Hub on Open Democracy. He specializes in critical reflections on the interplay between human rights, power, inequality, ethnicity and class under conditions of globalization. He has pursued this interest through extensive research on precocious migration, trafficking and labor mobility involving both adults and children. Enjoy the lecture.
Good to see you all again, because I mean we've heard a lot about trafficking and I suppose illegal migration over the last couple of days. The one thing which I suppose we haven't said a lot about is the fact that whereas it is often the case that we associate things like border protection, anti-trafficking measures, anti-smuggling measures with the human rights of migrants, especially those who may be vulnerable, the stark truth, if we are all willing to admit it, is that it's also the criminalization of border crossings, which is very often associated with these initiatives. So very often, anti-trafficking, anti-smuggling initiatives are part of, if not informed by, border regulation or border control measures. And this is linked to the fact that, you know, state parties want the right or have the right to, sort of born out of a desire to control who enters or leave their territories and under what terms. So the huge amount of effort that has gone into some of the efforts that we've discussed over the last couple of days and are still being poured into it, we find from the research very rarely is intended specifically or exclusively to protect those who are vulnerable at the borders. Certainly, if you look at the kind of the scale of resources poured into creating fences, into patrolling borders and so on, it far outstrips the amount of money that goes into protecting the vulnerable. The strange thing as well is that history teaches us that has not always been the case. The immense interest we have in the last 20, 30 years, certainly, in protecting borders and prioritizing border controls over human rights, it's you could say, it's not new, but it has certainly been intensified. The scale of it has been ramped up much more so in the last couple of decades. I mean, take a classic example. During the Cold War, many in Western countries actually praised those who managed to escape from the kind of eastern side of the border. People who managed to help others smuggle across the border were not regarded as, if you want, breakers of the law per se. There was actually an interest in helping people to escape, you know, through tunnels, through other clandestine means, rather than clamping down on that measure. So these migrant journeys, you could say, were facilitated by smugglers and other parties, which are now counted among the groups we refer to as organized criminal groups and so on and so forth. You can even think about the ongoing Ukrainian war. I don't think any of us would fault someone who helped a Ukrainian family that is in distress to cross a border through means that are not necessarily legal. I mean, it's a great thing that many countries have opened borders and opened legal channels to Ukrainians fleeing the war. But we know that is not the case for many other countries. There are countries such as Afghanistan, Iraq, and others, whose citizens are also similarly fleeing long-standing conflicts and so on, but who are given a very different treatment when we look at, you know, the situation. I mean, think of Syrians, people from Yemen, from Libya, Eritrea, and elsewhere. The key point I'm trying to highlight here is, you know, at the very start of this session, is the fact that social practices and the meanings we attribute to them are not sort of fixed in time. And I really want to emphasize that how we understand these things, they are the laws, they are the conventions which we have created, but these meanings shift, they evolve. And so the meanings we attribute to acts of migration and mobility and so on, whether we accept them or criminalize them, whether we praise or condemn and so on, is determined by factors such as time, space, place, the politics around it, but also by questions around social identity, like nationality and so on and so forth. I accept that some of the things I'm saying may be a bit controversial. I'm pushing out the boundaries a bit. We have seen some of this yesterday. And the reason I am, again, trying to get us to consider that the laws and the structures within which we work are not fixed, you know, they are constructed, they are created, they change and evolve. It's not, again, or being controversial, it's not simply because I want us to think about these things when we turn to the intellectual, academic, and also practical exercise I want us to conduct later on. I am not pushing at the boundaries just to be controversial for the sake of it. But also, I think because I really want us to see that there are other imaginaries, there are other possibilities for how we can promote the rights of migrants, the rights of the vulnerable outside the sorts of structures which we have at the moment. We have to work within, you know, there's a saying, we work with the world as it is, not as how we want it to be. That is true. But equally, I hope that as human rights practitioners, as migration practitioners, we are willing to give ourselves the space to consider what else is possible, what sorts of alternatives we can think about when we are exploring issues to do with migration and so on and so forth. And I say this again because while the established conventions and legal positions are very important, they can also sometimes restrict our vision of the world. They can make it difficult for us to see beyond the kinds of structures that these laws and systems and structures put before us. And we can even start to see them as simply natural, or the order of things as created somewhat organically or coming out of nature, when in reality the fact is that we have constructed and produced them the way they currently are. And I'll give you an example, which, you know, when I teach one of my lectures on mass migration, I ask my students to tell me which part of the world they believe is most likely to be involved in mass migration, or involved to, you know, to be more likely to want to migrate. And they all say, you know, they name a country in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think we've heard some of it in these sessions today. And yet, in reality, the data says something completely different. The IOM, through its research, through its expansive volume of data, came to the conclusion that Africa-Europe migration is one of the most misunderstood aspects of migration in the, you know, in the global migration studies. Because the reality is that 80% of migration in Africa, or among Africans, occurs around the continent. And in fact, because of the sheer amount of controls that have been placed on the mobility, you know, think about the lack of passports that can get people around. Think about the sorts of humiliating processes people have to go through to apply for a visa and be refused several times over. Because of all of these measures, Africans are the least likely globally to be able to migrate. If you look at the proportion of the continent versus, you know, those of us who live in Europe, in North America and elsewhere, we are in a far better position to be able to migrate and do so if you have a European passport than someone who is on that side of the fence. And so with this preamble out of the way, we're going to think about a case study which relates to the issue of human trafficking. There are these sheets that I want you to use in your groups. I want you to think about, A, whether you believe the case that is being presented represents a case of trafficking or not. Here are the questions. B, what is the rationale for the response which you have adopted? And C, what solution or outcome would you like if you were in the position of the party who has been arrested at the point described in the case study? We shall look at the definition of trafficking and some of the debates around it, and I think Katrina's presentation was very helpful, which is why I have skipped that segment of my presentation, because I don't want to get us bogged down in the technical details so much. Once again, we will look at the trafficking definition itself in a minute, but for now I want us all to bring to bear our understanding of how trafficking looks like, how it is understood and promoted and so on and so forth in our individual workplaces, in our communities, in our countries and so on, using the case study which I have presented, which Sonia will distribute shortly. And then once we've all done that, we shall look at the definitions and whether they fit with how we've constructed the problem and also some of the critiques around it. And I suppose here I'm also trying to get us to, as I said, this is a space in which I think we can explore alternative possibilities, work outside the boundaries. And it may be, you could say, pie in the sky or simply not realistic, some of the things you might say. But I suppose we want to give ourselves the space to imagine, to dream. I want us to undertake something similar to, you know, John Rawls' idea of the veil of ignorance. John Rawls says that to create a more equitable and more much fairer society, one way we could do that is to imagine that we are entering a space where our status or our social identity is unknown. We could end up being black, brown, yellow, purple, whatever color you associate with a human being. Your passport status is not known. Your social class, whether you're going to be rich or poor, is not known. And try to create the parameters for this society. So if you were entering this society with your status unknown, how would you want that society to be? Would you want it to be exactly as things are at the moment? Or would you want it to look maybe different to how things stand at the moment? So it's like a thought experiment. Imagine that you are at complete ground zero, and you are entering a space where you could end up anything at all, anyone at all, any social identity at all. How would you want that space to look like? How would you want it to be for you, or indeed for others? So maybe imagine that possibility as well in considering the case study, which Sonia is now going to distribute. So
the following case study was presented to the audience, followed by a workshop session. Following three unsuccessful attempts to acquire a visa, student, visitor, and partner, MM, a 25-year-old Nigerian man, solicited the services of travel facilitator to help him travel to Europe. Lacking the means to pay the travel facilitator upfront, the two parties reached an agreement that the facilitator will bear the cost of MM's journey upfront to be repaid with interest. Instead of the original charge of £6,000, MM was going to repay £18,000 if the facilitator managed to help him to get to Europe. The agreement also included a promise to find him employment to ensure that he could repay the debt. Upon arrival, M.M. found himself in a more difficult situation than he had anticipated. The facilitator found him work in the underground economy, mainly factories and farms in remote areas, where he rarely had contact with the outside. Nearly all his earnings were retained by the facilitator or people working for him under the pretext that this was being used to repay his debt. He barely had enough money for food and basic needs. He contemplated going elsewhere, but was afraid of being apprehended by immigration or police, as he did not want to go back to Nigeria, despite the difficulties he was facing. Unfortunately, following an immigration swoop at a factory where he was working one day, M.M. was arrested. Do you consider M.M. as a victim of trafficking? Why do you agree or disagree that he is a victim of trafficking? What solution or course of action would you like to have if you were M.M.?
I will pick it up from what Group 8 has just said. When I interviewed M.M. in Ghana, where he had traveled from Nigeria to try once more to migrate, because he had been deported, and that is the stark reality which a lot of people whose situation seems to fit clearly in the trafficking box are facing in many of our countries. Katrina mentioned this point, and it has been reiterated by the UN Special Rapporteur on Trafficking in Persons in 2020, when she made the point calling for a kind of ground zero, sort of going back to basics, ignoring the kind of completely dismantling the Palermo Protocol. We hosted a debate on our Open Democracy platform about, you know, taking stock of the Palermo Protocol 20 years after its formation to see how much it has achieved in terms of protecting victims, which to many of us should be the priority. And it was obvious, because if you look in many countries, far more people find themselves actually out of protection than in protection, despite the persistent information that we're given about trafficking as a rampant and prolific human rights violation. So her argument was that only a few hundred out of the purported 20 million people identified as or deemed to be victims of trafficking have received support. And so the point here is that much as we, I guess for many of us, what we often think about is whether this is a feature of the anti-trafficking framework or a bug. Is this simply a slip up of how the law is meant to work, or is it how it's meant to function, i.e. do other things as well? And I think we can see that very clearly when we look at the genesis of the Palermo Protocol, because many of us are very much optimistic about the use of the law to help us to tackle the issues that we face. But very often there are also other considerations that do not necessarily cohere with the sort of issues or the understanding that we might want as human rights experts, as migration scholars, and as people who are more about the protection of migrants' rights than other considerations. So in the early 80s, as some of us are aware, I'll very briefly chart the origin of the Palermo Protocol. In the early 80s, and this has started long before, global leaders were concerned about several things. One, there wasn't any dedicated international legal framework or convention for the protection of migrants' rights, or to give them their full human rights as in the same way as citizens. There was also a recognition that there was an increasing concern about unauthorized border crossings under the context of what we now call smuggling and trafficking. And there wasn't a dedicated international human rights instrument for that. There was also a significant increase, global leaders believed, in the activities of organized criminal groups as well, so bodies which were profiting from this sort of space. And fourth, there were also concerns that these groups could pose a danger to the interests of the state. So these are the key underlying ideas, which eventually led to the formation in 1998 of an ad hoc committee to come up or to develop an international convention, which will serve as the bedrock for tackling these four or five issues I have just mentioned. And eventually in 2000, we saw this new convention called the UN Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, with three protocols, the first of which is of main interest to us, which is the protocol to prevent, suppress, and punish trafficking in persons, especially women and children. And I'm not going to bore you with these definitions. I'm sure you've seen them everywhere in your work. But when we think about trafficking, this is what it means. And as we've all said, in our view, MM's case fits clearly this, at least in the majority of cases. There was some debate among some groups, but certainly most of us believe that it fits the bill. We think about consent. Again, consent was one of the issues which our groups considered, and we felt that MM hadn't perhaps consented to the form of wage theft and withholding of his wage and the kinds of insecurities he was enduring when he was when he eventually arrived, and so on and so forth. But the first point, again, I saw many of you talking about what's called the AMP, the act, the means, and the purpose. Again, I'm not going to belabor that point. I'm sure many of us know about it. But the key thing is that there are often oppositional or competing ideals. Remember, the Palermo Protocol came out of several different interests. It had a concern about border crossing or unauthorized border crossing. It had concerns about organized crime. It had concerns about the vulnerability of migrants. So at the very outset, there are these different competing concerns within the protocol. And so when some of us ask whether the kinds of lack of protections victims receive is, just to use the technology term again, a feature or a bug, I think many people feel, including the anti-trafficking special rapporteur, that perhaps as optimistic as some of us are about working within this framework, our optimism might also be misjudged, simply because the structure itself has got very different agendas, very different goals. You look at the aims and the kinds of interests of different parties, even within the structure. If you put aside the definitions, government and state parties have got migration controls. Migration is a very politically sensitive topic. We were discussing this earlier. You speak with government officials in many countries, they talk about the real need for labor in their countries. And you say, well, what about making the case for migration? And they look at you as if you're mad, because it's a sensitive topic politically. And going back to the point I made at the beginning of this session, it is not sensitive because it's naturally so. We have made it so. The discourses we've promoted, the kinds of narratives and rhetoric we've promoted about migration has resulted in a scenario where, even if it seems logical or rational to have people who are willing and ready to do the jobs that are outstanding to help our economies, to help our society, to make a better world, we actively have, our government against it. No government that I know of is very much sort of open or positive about migration. Very often you hear politicians talking about how to stop rather than how to promote, migration in a sense. And you saw this clearly in the case of MM, because in the interview, he disclosed that he had spent even more money trying to migrate legally than illegally. He had applied 3 times as a student, a legitimate student. I met him, I saw his family, I spoke to community members about him. He's a decent guy, he's an honest, genuine, sincere guy. He'd applied for a student visa, paid the deposit, paid all the necessary fees, done his tuberculosis and all of these other tests that students at the time needed to do. And then the immigration officer had refused him under
the belief that he wasn't a genuine student. So the question of disbelief really presents a huge challenge to many people who are genuine, sincere people trying to migrate. And MM was one of those cases. It wasn't simply in the context of his attempt to migrate as a student, but also in his immigration hearing when he was arrested, because the people who were prosecuting him as an immigration offender simply didn't believe his story, no matter the fact that it was completely genuine. And as all of us have said, it seemed like a clear-cut case of trafficking. But as I say, there are competing features. It is not simply about his best interest. There are all of these other interests that are also in play in the context of trafficking, and that poses a huge challenge. So first of all, his student visa application was refused. He tried two times to two different European countries, spent a lot of money, many nights writing student applications, you know, personal statements and everything. The universities gave him admission, went through the process, and then was refused. His girlfriend, who was in Nigeria at the time, migrated to the UK, and so they tried to do a partner visa application. Again, they were told they didn't believe they were a genuine couple, and these are people who had lived together as boyfriend and girlfriend for many years, and you know, well known as partners, but again, they were disbelieved, and the visa was refused. So the third one, as we saw, was when he just wanted to apply as a visitor. And the problem with visa applications is that the more you try, the more some embassies start to think that, well, you look too desperate, and maybe we think, you know, you must have something ulterior, rather than the fact that many of us simply want to see the world beyond our societies. Remember the tyranny of passports, or the kind of the lottery of passports. Many of us don't have to think about applying for visas, but those who do and have had to make a case and have been refused are effectively, it's a track record of disbelief surrounding them. And this came up in his immigration hearing in the UK, because they looked at his history of refusals and said, well, we think that you have a record of lying, because, you know, you've tried to apply as a student, you've tried to apply as others, and very animated, obviously, about this case, and have been refused. And so that came into the discourse for his you know, refusal of his case as a one of trafficking. So there are these competing interests, as I'm saying. Governments and state parties have got vested interest in the number of trafficking cases that are in their country. So some might say we are simply a transit point rather than a destination point, or maybe a source point, for a whole variety of reasons. Because as we saw in the charts which Katrina showed earlier, the statistics are not neutral, right? To be associated with 1,000 cases or 20,000 cases, numbers say something. They aren't simply inert or simply figures we throw out there. They have questions to do with how a country's human rights, human rights status is perceived. Think of how the U.S. Trafficking in Persons report and the Global Slavery Index, and all of these indices are used for calculations of different sorts. And I mean, there are criticisms of these, you know, global slavery indices and others, because one might say that, again, it shows the global hegemony of things, because the kinds of ways in which the calculations are done, some might argue, seems to be the richest countries of the world effectively praising themselves for doing very, very good, whereas the poorest aren't. So if you were to flip the calculations upside down and look at, say, things to do with forced labor, you look at a country like Congo, which is often at the top of some of these countries which are seen to be doing very poorly in human rights provisions, and you ask yourself, but where does the output of the exploitation in Congo end up? It's mostly in the rich countries. Look at all the devices we're using on our tables here. There's probably a bit of Congo DRC in every single device on our table. But we wouldn't have a global slavery index that talks about countries which benefit from forced labor. It's more about the forced labor itself. So all I'm saying, again, thinking about the point where I started, is that these debates are not neutral. They are political. They reflect a whole range of social, political, and economic calculations. So government and state parties have got interest in a number of cases that are recorded in their country. Anti-prostitution NGOs are accused often of conflating sex work with sex trafficking for their own advocacy. As migrants' rights advocates, we regularly, you know, talk about the ways in which migrants' rights are not protected. We are all making a range of claims within the same space, very often in ways which are not in harmony with each other. And so some argue, therefore, that maybe, and this is what I was saying earlier about imagining a different world, maybe joining the anti-trafficking special rapporteur's call for a revision of the trafficking protocol. What some argue, and I don't know what you think about it, we can discuss this later on, is that perhaps we need to think, if we are primarily interested in the best interest of victims rather than all of these other competing interests, or, you know, organized crime or border protection, then maybe what we require is a standalone convention, a standalone framework which has got nothing to do with border protection, which is all about those who have been exploited, those who have been abused, people like MM, whose cases we all agree fits within the normative understanding, but which in the immigration context was completely disregarded because of the other considerations. So that's the first point. The other is that actually putting trafficking together with initiatives and policies that are also about migration control means that, again, the question of whether it's a feature or a bug comes up again, in the sense that migration controls very often will take priority of over the best interest. I'm going to skip this for time purposes, but that is the central point I'm trying to make. Get us to consider the ways in which we can better protect migrants, we can promote their best interest. And one of the ways that has been suggested is that maybe the Palermo Protocol ought to be revised, a standalone convention specifically for protecting the best interests of migrants. And that's for us to think about as we go about the rest of our day. Thank you very much.
This lecture was part of the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia, as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.